You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
The Kyoto Protocol is the only international climate change treaty with legally binding carbon emission reduction targets. Perhaps that's why big oil companies and their supporters don't like it. And the conservatives have strongly criticized the accord since before coming to power in 2006, but this week, with its majority in parliament, the conservative government officially pulled Canada out of the Kyoto Protocol. The move comes after over a week of intense discussion and debate on what to do about climate change at the major international conference held in Durban, South Africa. Andrea Harden-Donoghue is the energy and climate campaigner for the Council of Canadians, and Red Eye Collective member Manuel Schulte spoke with her earlier this week via telephone from Ottawa. Manuel began by asking Andrea to summarize the current state of climate health.
There are varying degrees of what is said, but generally climate scientists are saying certainly no more than 2 degrees is what we should limit our temperature rise. Many more are leading towards 1 or 1.5 degrees or 300 parts per million. And certainly with the UN's gigaton gap report, the question of whether a tipping point has already happened or is about to happen. And a tipping point, of course, is beyond the time. The time beyond that, there's going to be just sort of things that happen, feedback loops that happen and create more climate change because of what we've already emitted. That question is a really big question right about now. And certainly the main thing that we need to take away from it is there's no doubt that we need to be acting now to reduce our emissions and to do so rapidly.
How does the Kyoto Protocol fit into this compared to what's coming out of what's been coming out of Durban? How does it make it more likely that we are to act effectively with regards to climate change?
Well, there's good and bad parts of the Kyoto Protocol. So some of the good parts is that it did set emission reduction targets, very clear ones, and that it has monitoring and compliance mechanisms. So every year Canada has to submit an inventory to the UN that notes the trend in our emissions. These are important pieces of that legislation. The bad parts of Kyoto are that under Kyoto we saw market mechanisms get developed. So the ability of countries in the global north, now if we had actually reduced our emissions, our country might be participating in this, but we aren't because we're not complying. But it allows the capacity for countries to buy carbon credits generated by carbon offset projects through the carbon trading market. And now that's highly problematic because it allows countries like the EU, through the EU carbon market, to not reduce their emissions domestically and instead rely on these carbon credits generated from projects in the global south. There's many studies suggesting that these projects aren't actually reducing emissions beyond what they would were the credits not available, and also are implicated in a number of social and environmental side effects that just aren't acceptable. So this is what I mean by saying there are good and bad aspects to the Kyoto Protocol. Now, what we've seen happen is a shift away from those good aspects of the Kyoto Protocol, so commitment to setting the binding targets and that legal framework that has existed for a number of years now, to this Durban platform, which builds on what was tabled in Copenhagen and Cancun, which aims to be legally binding but won't actually come into place till 2020, so a very insufficient timeline. And we're seeing a push for an expansion of the market mechanisms in there, so all the bad aspects of the Kyoto Protocol are sort of being brought forward and expanded on, while the good aspects of the Kyoto Protocol are being rolled back.
One of the reasons that the Conservative government gave for pulling out of Kyoto is that it would cost Canada tens of billions of dollars. And it also gives arguments like that Canada only contributes a small fraction of global greenhouse gas emissions. How seriously, given the government's alignment with oil interests and with climate deniers, how seriously should we be taking their arguments? How much weight can we give them?
Well, those are two arguments that I must admit make my eyes roll, because First of all, the first one is just inaccurate. It's plain inaccurate. There is no multi-million-dollar cost for staying in Kyoto Protocol. That's a lie. What there is if we chose to comply with the Kyoto Protocol, which we haven't as of yet, then to meet our 2012 emission reduction target, we would have to buy the multi-million dollar number that Ken keeps using. That's the amount of money we would have to pay for those carbon credits. Now, we could continue to stay in the Kyoto Protocol and not pay that and not comply, which is what we've done since we've ratified it, right? So what this really amounts to is that's just a piece of fear-mongering. And what it really amounts to is not wanting to be part of this this protocol, and I suspect not wanting to fulfill the monitoring and compliance mechanisms, because on a yearly basis it provides an opportunity for those of us watching it to really demonstrate to Canadians and the world how poorly we are addressing this requirement and this need to reduce emissions. So that's certainly the first point. And in terms of 2% of global emissions, well, this is just wordsmithing, essentially, in my mind. First of all, we have to understand that as Canadians, we have one of the highest per capita emissions in the world. So that has to be part of the consideration. But it's also, in a way, a very childish thing to say. I only did so much, so, you know, I'm not going to contribute to this process. It's, you know, we're facing a climate crisis where we need governments to step up and to take leadership on this, and this is just a scapegoat, essentially, is what it is. It's like saying the other scapegoat we often see is, you know, the tar sands are only a small amount of our national emissions. Again, this is not very accurate. I believe they're 4% of our national emissions now, but with a planned expansion, we're looking at the tar sands alone comprising 11% of our national greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. So even that 2% number, we're going to see that rise based on just the expansion plans we're seeing in the tar sands.
The media has reported that the Durban conference made significant progress towards an international agreement to which all of the big players, including the United States and China, could sign on to. Looking forward with Durban, what's your take on the potential for it actually to reach some kind of reasonable agreement?
Well, I think part of what's being reported on is sort of just in response to the reality that these talks didn't completely break down and, you know, cease to exist. Because I think at different points during the Cancun climate talks and the Durban climate talks, you know, that was a reality that people were grappling with. So certainly the political space has continued, the institution has continued. But that by no means means that it's a positive international agreement. In many ways, our analysis is that, you know, this is a weaker international agreement, this Durban platform that's being discussed. The timeline is too long, 2020, for an actual deal, and implementing it is ridiculous. The emission reduction targets being discussed so far are the pledges that were submitted under the Copenhagen Accord. We've been warned that these voluntary pledges could lead to up to a 3 to 5 degrees rise in global temperatures, which is just unacceptable. And, you know, we might see some change on that, but we haven't seen much indication of that so far. As I said, market mechanisms are looking to be expanded under the Durban platform, so more carbon offsets, expanding what's included in the carbon market, agriculture, soil, forests. These are big debates that happen at the Durban climate talks. So, yes, in one sense, there continues to be this political space, but are we seeing that political space provide the sort of solutions that we need? No. Certainly, it's important, we feel, for people to continue to monitor these talks and push for better. But certainly, we're looking more and more to what people can do in their communities across this country to seek climate justice.
Now, in terms of grassroots activism, there have been some pretty big successes in the last few months with the Keystone XL pipeline decision, which would ship oil from the tar sands to refineries in the U.S. That decision has been delayed. But the same kinds of grassroots pressure doesn't seem to have made much of a difference, you know, at these international conferences. What do you think we need to do in terms of grassroots pressure to kind of make more of an effect on these larger scales?
Well, I think we saw a bit of a change in tone at the Durban Climate Talks. There was actually an occupation held in the hallway right outside the plenary. So I'm certain the delegates meeting and talking about the Durban platform heard the cries of climate justice and heard the cries of people not polluters and the various other slogans. And I think that there was a bit of a change in tone with this sort of civil society organizing at the Durban Climate Talks. So I'm interested to see how that progresses. Certainly the Rio Plus 20 conference that's upcoming in Brazil in June is going to be a very big and important mobilizing moment. It is basically a fight over the heart of the green economy. Is it going to be equitable? Is it going to be responsible and accountable to people and to communities? Or is it going to be about privatizing and commodifying everything, air and water, and having a very market-oriented version and a corporate-oriented version of the green economy? So I think that that's something to watch, and certainly something we're seeing grassroots organizations and mobilizations look towards as a very important next space to be holding leaders accountable. Certainly we're doing that. But again, I think there is a really critical role to play right now of looking at what we can do in our communities to advance climate justice. And I think BC is a real hotbed right now. You've got a number of fights on your hand, be it coal exports, be it the pursuit of fracking, particularly around the Horn River Basin, which is very carbon intensive, and importantly the pipeline fights, Enbridge, Kinder Morgan, Pacific Trails. These are all really important fights that we can sort of dig our heels in on and get the right sort of information out and start mobilizing in our communities and make a difference.
Red Eye Collective member Manuel Schulte was in conversation with Andrea Harden Donahue. She is the energy and climate campaigner for the Council of Canadians. You can visit the Council of Canadian website. It's at canadians.org.